Obviously, the stock market and the global economy and everything have been in a state of flux. I thought it would be good to have this episode be a little bit of a mixed show where we talk about just your questions in general, which are honestly, I'm really shocked that you guys don't have more questions about the market and investing and coronavirus stuff and all that. So if you do have those kind of questions or, you know, just regular student loan questions, hit us up, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. Just press the record button on your phone, speak like a minute question into the thing. And if it's a good question, we'll feature it on the air and I'll answer it. So we've got four questions I'm going to start the show off with today. Actually, surprisingly, not that related to coronavirus. And then we will kind of get into the second part of the show where I'm going to be digging into a little bit of my hot takes on what's going on with the world economy right now. First, we have a question from a dental resident about what to do with her student loans.
Hi, Travis. I'm a resident that graduated from dental school with about a $450,000 loan. I have two questions. I'm currently on repay, making $0 payments since September of last year, just to have half of that interest subsidized by the government. And I plan on being on this plan for the next 2 years while finishing up residency. So my question would be, is repay still the best plan if I, A, plan to get married, since the income of my partner would also be accounted for in the 10% income calculation? And if I also end up with a high income job after residency, just because I know that there's no cap in monthly payments with repay. And if not, what happens if I switch to a different plan that's more suitable and has a cap? Would my $0 payments that I've made since September be reset and such? My second question is, I'm also considering PSLF, but I have not signed up for it yet. My question would be, should I apply for it now or wait until the end of the potential 10 years to apply? My concern is if my loans get moved to the new servicer, would my payments also be reset? And I also know that there's some kind of admin forbearance while it moves to the new servicer. So I'm wondering if the interest that is unpaid would capitalize onto my loan or to my principal. So yeah, if you can give me some advice, that'd be great. Thank you so much.
So a couple things about this. The reason that I like the pay-as-you-earn plan for people that are pursuing forgiveness is that a lot of times people go from being single to being married. And if you go from being single to being married, it's a lot easier to have a conversation of, hey, I already have a plan for that. I can simply file our taxes married filing separately and exclude your income if you have no student loan debt versus, oh, by the way, I'm going to be taking 10% of your income towards my student loan payment. Thank you very much. For that reason, the repay plan might be a better plan if you're going to pay your debt back. So if you're going to pay your debt back, then the subsidy for your repay plan is probably a good thing. But if you're not going to pay your debt back because it's going to get forgiven, then why not go ahead and get it set up on the right plan from the very beginning? I think unless you're like a dental anesthesiologist or maybe an oral surgeon or something, you're probably not going to make enough money taxable income wise to justify paying back $450,000 of dental school debt. There's obviously exceptions to that. And if you're making a lot of money as a general dentist in an out-of-the-way area, then you might need to pay your debt back instead. But probably you won't need to pay that debt back. It's probably going to be better to be forgiven just, you know, based off of the limited information that we have here. So in terms of applying for PSLF, you know, I very rarely see dentists that get PSLF. Obviously, you know, whenever I say that, people send me an email at podcast@studentloanplanner.com and they're like, hey, I'm a dentist with PSLF, holla. But most dentists don't, because to get a public dentistry job and to keep it 10 years, you've got to do fill and drill dentistry for 10 years. And most people just get tired. I mean, their backs give out. It's just exhausting, right? And most dentists will do it for a few years, but they won't consistently do it for 10. I would say that if you're really sure you're going to get public service loan forgiveness, then the sooner you apply, the better. But in your case, like, I would probably tend to lean towards more just doing pay-as-you-earn strategy. You can pay $5 to switch repayment plans on studentaid.gov, and it takes about a month to change over. And they should use your prior year taxable income to certify you again. So your payment shouldn't really go way up. Could everything work out fine? Yes, because you could do repay for a couple of years. And technically, under today's rules, you're allowed to switch without penalty. But the issue would be, if you have a new president that locks everybody into the repayment plan they're already using, and that you have no flexibility at all, that's a real risk that could happen. So that's why I generally tell people, get on the plan that best fits your future projected life and stick with it and think about other things besides your student loans. Now a question from Elena.
Hi, Travis. My name is Elena. I'm calling from the Midwest. I'd like to thank you for all that you do. I have been following you for the last couple of months after discovering you on your podcast, and I really appreciate the advice that you give to student loan borrowers. My situation is as follows. I had $122,000 of student loans that were unsubsidized, which I have consolidated. They are at 6.25%. Consolidated that about 4 years ago when I'd graduated from a master's degree. That balance has ballooned to $154,000. At that time, I'd also consolidated subsidized loans, which were $33,000, and they are at 6.25%. So both of those consolidation loans are my undergrad and my master's, if I remember correctly. My question to you is, I have three loans that are not consolidated. They are for my doctoral work. One loan at $6,300 and a second loan at $7,700, totaling about $14,000, both at 5.75%. And a third loan at $24,500 at 5.59%. I did not finish my doctorate degree and had to withdraw from the doctorate program for a variety of reasons and went to work for a federal hospital in clinical research. And currently do that work, and I hope to remain in the federal program, PSLF, under the repay for 8 more years in order to get my loans forgiven. So my question to you is, do you think there's any value for me to get these three loans for my doc program consolidated under current low interest, or should I continue as is? Because if I consolidate, I would lose about 18 months worth of payments. Or 18 payments worth towards the 120 payment ticker, or the goal of 120 payments for this 10-year student loan forgiveness or public service loan forgiveness. Would you let me know your thoughts about that? Thank you.
So Elena's got, sounded like about 200,000 of student loans in total, or maybe a little under that. And she's using revised pay-as-you-earn to pay them back. And she's thinking, well, I've got these three random loans. Should I try to pay them off? Because they're kind of not bunched in with the big giant consolidated loans, and I could get maybe those at a lower interest rate. So this is a great question. Remember this, PSLF almost always has a negative interest rate, which means that public service loan forgiveness on anything is going to beat any interest rate, including a 0% interest rate, because the interest rate here is negative. So yeah, we have interest rates falling because of coronavirus and things like that. But even if you got a 0% refinancing deal, you're not going to beat public service loan forgiveness. So if you have 18 months of credit, you need to leave these loans alone. Do not touch them. Make sure that you continue submitting your PSLF ECF form and just keep getting credit for them. And I'm assuming that they qualify along with those other loans. And there's really no upside to consolidating these. In fact, there's actually a big downside, because not only do you wipe away, and I'm assuming you meant refinance when you said consolidate the way you said it, but you know, if you consolidate your student loans, then you actually wipe away the credit, but you also eliminate the standard 10-year plan. And you know, the standard 10-year plan counts for PSLF. So imagine a scenario where you have $30,000, and you know, on top of the giant student loans that you have, and you consolidate them, well, you lose the standard 10-year plan. For those extra 2 years or something that you need to make PSLF payments, you could only pay standard 10-year, which is like $300 a month, versus paying repay 10% with no cap. Well, you could be paying $1,000 a month, maybe, if you're making a six-figure income. There's actually a lot of strategy behind this, but I would say leave these loans alone and get public service loan forgiveness and the whole thing. Now, Alec has a question about hedging PSLF risk.
Hi, Travis. I had a question about hedging against PSLF. I'm a fourth-year medical student with a training program of 5 plus an additional year for fellowship. At this stage, academic versus private practice is very much up in the air. I read about a plan to do repay, taking advantage of the subsidies, until I have a better idea where I will end up. If in the event I decide to do academic and pursue PSLF, it would make the most sense to be on pay, and I could switch at that point, probably in my PGY 4 or 5 year in order to maintain my hardship status. I'm wondering how to calculate the two routes should I decide to go with one over the other. I'm aware that changing plan causes capitalization, but was unsure of the other penalties or issues with switching that late. And I'm assuming I would still qualify for hardship if I made the switch in residency. Obviously, there are a number of factors that go into choosing a practice setting, but I was curious what the decision would look like through a strictly financial lens. Thanks for your help.
So Alex's question is basically, what do I do if I'm not sure about going for PSLF versus something else? Is there a smart strategy to use? Maybe I can do a repay, get a little subsidies, still get some PSLF credit while I'm trying to figure things out. So here's what I would tell you. It never, almost never makes sense to take a job financially because you're getting public service loan forgiveness, especially in medicine. Because if you're doing a five-year training period plus a one-year fellowship, my guess is you're earning some sort of high, you're going to be in some sort of high earning specialty. If you're going to be in a high earning specialty, usually the cost or the value rather of PSLF is about $50,000 to $100,000 for an attending in terms of how much extra your pre-tax income needs to be to justify doing private practice versus a not-for-profit setting. So if you think about the difference between an academic salary, let's just say urology, where you might make $300,000 a year versus private practice urology, where you might make $500,000 a year, let's say, then that would be kind of a no-brainer to take that approach of just saying, hey, I want to go private practice and pay off my loans. In that event, the difference in the size of your debt will not be that giant, because remember that student loan interest grows at a simple rate of interest versus a exponential compounding rate of interest as long as you're signed up for an income-driven plan. So if you're single and not married, I think that it's reasonable to do the revised pay-as-you-earn plan. The only risk that you run is if you owe a rather small amount, then your payment is going to be 10% of your, you know, income, and that payment could be above the cap depending on what the size of your debt is. So I would say if you have a large medical school debt, you have nothing to worry about. Just do repay. The worst thing is you might consider not getting legally married if you have a spouse in the picture or a potential spouse in the picture to keep your payments low. And then it'll work out where you get the subsidies and the interest, and you'll save some money on obviously refinancing if you do that at some point. And then with pay as you earn, you know, that's a better plan for certainly smaller amounts. Pay as you earn is a nice plan for people that have smaller amounts that think they're going to get PSLF, because you can still get quite a bit forgiven. You know, you can actually, even if you have $100,000 in medical school debt and you're making $500,000 as some sort of brain surgeon or something in an academic hospital, you can still get about half of that debt forgiven. And the way that happens is you pay 10% of your income as a trainee, as resident or fellow, which is very, very low. And then you have your payment plan capped at a pay-as-you-earn plan type approach, which means, you know, standard 10-year plan over, say, 5 years, you'd pay off about half of your balance and the rest of it would be forgiven. But I just want to stress that you really can't make an awful decision here. Repay sounds fine to do in this case. Would like to know a little bit more information to be sure about that recommendation, but it certainly seems like it's a reasonable approach. Now we have a question from an anonymous listener about what to do, Roth versus traditional.
Hi, Travis. I was hoping to get your thoughts on traditional versus Roth accounts, specifically contributing to 401k accounts. I'm a second-year resident with about $200,000 of student loans planning on public service loan forgiveness. I make about $60,000 a year, and my wife makes about $80,000 a year. We've been filing taxes, married filing separately for student loan purposes for the past 2 years. Last year, fortunately, we were able to max out our 401k and our backdoor Roth IRA accounts, and our employer this year is adding a Roth 401k option with the same match as the traditional 401k account that we currently have. I know contributing to traditional accounts would decrease our adjusted gross income and decrease our tax burden and student loan payments, but we do plan on an early retirement, and I can't determine which account would be better given all of these factors combined. I would really appreciate your thoughts on this, and I appreciate all of the work that you and your colleagues do. Thank you.
That's a great question. The person said that they want to retire early. So right away, the answer is traditional, because right now, this person's probably in a 22% federal marginal tax bracket. I believe that that tax bracket starts at around $70,000 something plus a $24,000 standard deduction for being married. So probably you're well within this 22% marginal federal tax bracket. In that case, that's telling you that if you maximize your pre-tax traditional IRAs, you're saving at a 22% federal rate. On top of that, if you're pursuing public service loan forgiveness, you're saving an additional 10% on that. So that's 32%. Now layer on the idea that you might be being taxed at the state level potentially. That might be 5 to 10% depending on what state you live in. So now your tax rate savings are anywhere from 37% to 40-something percent by doing the traditional for the full max contribution. And since this person's considering early retirement, it's very likely that in retirement, they will use smart tax strategies to realize less than $100,000 of income as a married couple. In that case, they also might reestablish their residence in a low or no income tax state while they nomadically travel the world. In that case, their marginal total tax rate post-PSLF and post-retirement would probably be in that smallest bracket of about 12%. That's a lot lower number than 37 to 40-something percent. So even if you paid a 10% penalty to get access to your traditional money early, you'd still be paying taxes at about half of the rate that you'd be paying taxes on if you did the Roth versus the traditional. There's nothing wrong with the Roth account. It's a helpful account. If you think that you're going to be in a massively higher income tax bracket, then certainly Roth accounts are great. But the problem is if you have that mentality, then you've kind of won the game. If you're that maxed out with your Roth and you've contributed that much to your Roth IRAs and traditional, or I mean Roth 401ks, the real risk is not that you will have to pay a lot in taxes in retirement. The risk is that you won't have enough assets to comfortably retire. That's a much bigger risk. And the traditional accounts allow you to put away more assets because it gives you the big tax break and it gives you money left over for putting money in things like just regular brokerage accounts, which nobody tends to think about because people don't get pushed by their employer to do them, but they're as important, if not more important even than retirement accounts, because you can contribute an unlimited sum versus a limited sum for tax-protected, tax-deferred accounts. So that would be my thought. Thanks for the question. All right, so now for the juicy part of the show. We're going to talk about my thoughts about coronavirus, markets, all the craziness that's going on. Are we going to have a recession? What is it going to mean for you? Should you invest? All these things, right? So first off, let's just get the elephant out of the room. So coronavirus is obviously a serious thing. It's obviously going to be with us for a little while, it seems like, and it's going to result in human misery and tragedy, which is never, ever something to take for granted in terms of the sadness of that, right? Get that out of the way. So we can talk about tragedies in the world, but if you did that, then that's all you'd ever talk about. You'd be sad all the time. That's just not a way to live life. So I think you have to assess this from a rational perspective and say, what does this mean for me and my family, and how worried do I need to be, and what can I do with my money to make smart decisions for the long term? First off, it is extremely unlikely that this thing gets anywhere close to as bad as the worst outbreak we had 100 years ago, which was the Spanish flu. I've been doing a lot of research about this, a lot of reading just historically. It's such an interesting comparison. The Spanish flu basically is this thing that happened during the end of World War I, and a bunch of sailors and soldiers basically exported it around the world from all the traveling that everybody was doing, from moving all these people to these places they don't normally go, and to super unsanitary conditions like trenches, and these people were getting sick and spreading it all over the world. What would happen is it would create things called cytokine storms. Basically, that means that your body drops the nuclear bomb, immune defense mechanism, and young people's bodies are much better at doing this than older people's bodies. And so what would happen is that very reaction in this case would actually kill people. So you had with the Spanish flu, young people and children and, you know, active adults that were very physically healthy otherwise were the main victims here. And, you know, for example, pregnant women had a 30 to 70% mortality rate in the Spanish flu 100 years ago. So just really off the charts in terms of how much damage this did. 100 million people died worldwide. You can have perspective and also treat something seriously, right? So I'm not saying coronavirus isn't serious. I'm just saying have perspective about what this means. So what happened with the stock market is the stock market fell around 15%. And then the next 5 years after the virus ended, or, you know, became less of a concern, the stock market went up double in value. So here's something that's kind of interesting. Everybody kind of assumes that the Spanish flu was this one thing that happened and then people didn't have to deal with it anymore. But actually, that's not the case. So I looked up this link from the Philadelphia Inquirer looking at the deaths per 100,000 from flu over the years. Deaths per 100,000 was basically 612 during the flu pandemic in 1918. So that's like a 0.6% death rate in a single year from the flu. Now, what's crazy is if you look at about 5 years later, like 1920s time frame, there were still like a couple hundred people per 100,000 dying of flu. So flu was still extremely deadly well after the Spanish flu pandemic, but life moved on and people kept doing, you know, the normal things that they would usually do. And it's actually not until the influenza vaccine was developed in like the 40s and 50s, that death rates actually came down a lot from the flu. And so then in 1950, basically, well, actually, I should say 1940, the death rate was around 100 per 100,000. So about 0.1% of the population would die from the flu in any given year, according to these stats. And then basically the, and this is including pneumonia and influenza, by the way, but in the 1950, the death rate was 50 per 100,000. So it fell by half from 1940 to 1950. And then, you know, it basically fell by half from the 20s and 30s to 1940, right? So it fell by half 1920s to 1940s, fell by half 1940s to 1950s. So then that death rate in, you know, continued to decline as about 30 per 100,000 in 1980. And then today, I mean, excluding coronavirus, it was 15. So it fell by half from 1980 to 2010. So flu is beginning less and less deadly. And you had this extremely dangerous virus mutation that happened and was transmitted everywhere with the Spanish flu. It killed 100 million people. And markets' reaction basically was a shrug. You know, I mean, 15% is really not that much compared to what happened with the Great Depression and world wars and things like that in terms of market decline. But the human suffering was on a scale that makes the coronavirus look like the common cold, you know, I mean, in terms of the amount of suffering that happened. So fears of economic global recession are what's really killing markets. Basically, the thought is this: if you have no tourism, with how interconnected the global economy is now, and, you know, that's going to cause all these emerging market countries to really suffer, because a lot of these countries, tourism is one of their top industries. So if those countries suffer, then their demand for imports and things like that declines. They might default on their emerging market bonds. So that means that those economies could go into a tailspin. Well, if those go into a tailspin, that can affect other companies around the world in places that are not connected to tourism. And then that's going to cause a decline in prices there. The thing that sent the stock market falling apart last week was Saudi Arabia and Russia got into a price war over oil. And already, you know, travel industry is not wanting a lot of oil right now, right? So then oil prices, you know, just absolutely collapsed. And so that just freaked people out. Basically, people are just terrified with what's going to happen with this coronavirus. So what does that mean? So stocks last week had their worst day since 2008. So what do you do? Is coronavirus going to kill everybody? Probably not, based off of how bad the Spanish flu was and based off of the fact that America and the world is so much richer now than we were back in the early 1900s. And America's only put a few billion dollars behind this. If America decided to, you know what, this is a global emergency, we're going to dump $100 billion into development of a vaccine for the coronavirus. You know, things still take time. Clinical trials still take time. But I think that there's a lot of things now with science that probably make us a lot more protected from all of these kind of outbreaks that can happen versus people hundreds or a thousand years ago with the Black Plague, right? So, okay, all well and good, right? But you know, I'm still losing lots of money. What do I do? So let's focus on what you can do. Now is a great time to tax lost harvest. So what that means is you take something that is a mutual fund in a taxable brokerage account that's very similar but not identical, and then you can basically trade those two mutual funds for each other and hold on to it for 30 days without losing any money, and then lock in a loss if you have a loss on paper that you can use to offset your taxes. So let's say you invested $10,000 in a brokerage account. Can't be a retirement because you can't tax loss harvest in a retirement account. So if you don't have any money in a retirement account, just ignore this. Say you have the $10,000 in a brokerage account. It falls from $10,000 to $7,000. So you have a $3,000 loss. And let's say that you own the VTSAX Total Stock Market Index Fund. You could sell that and you have a $3,000 loss. But what happens if the market turns around and that stock goes way, way up again? Well, then you just lost a bunch of money even though you saved money on taxes. So the loophole around this is there's something called VFIAX, which is the S&P 500 Index Fund at Vanguard. If you look at these two funds, they track each other with almost 100% correlation, but it's not a perfect 100% correlation, which is why there's a loophole here. So you could exchange that $7,000 mutual fund, the VTSAX Total Stock Market Index Fund, for the S&P 500 Index Fund and lock in that $3,000 loss without actually losing money, because if that mutual fund recovers, then you participated in that recovery. Now you have to hold on to that fund for 30 days And really, that's a good long-term holding anyway, so you might as well just keep it unless you could tax loss harvest again. But that $3,000 can be used to offset up to $3,000 of active income that you might have earned that year. So if you are in a high tax bracket, then that tax loss harvest compared to doing absolutely nothing saved you, let's say, 20, 30, 40% of $3,000. So that's pretty nice savings. Now, for international stocks, VTIAX is the Total International Stock Market Index Fund, something that is almost the exact same thing, but not quite, as VFWAX. That is a fund that is tracking a different benchmark. So that's why it's similar. It's got a 99% correlation pretty much, but it's not identical. So you're freaked out about coronavirus? Okay. Do some trading in your account where you're not really trading. You're just locking in tax loss harvesting to potentially save yourself thousands of dollars in taxes for years to come. I did this actually for my own personal account last week. I locked in a loss that probably will save me about $10,000 in taxes. And I didn't take a actual loss. I just took a paper loss by transferring a mutual fund from one thing to another that's almost the same thing. We cover this in our investing course. If you've already bought that, go to studentloanplannercourse.com and log in. If you haven't, don't worry. We're going to be probably coming out with a module about explaining everything that's happening with this big mess with the economy for the next time we open it, probably in July. So we do that to make sure that it's really updated and the latest content is there so people can really take action with it. So let's do some more Spanish flu comparisons. Okay, so this is just like otherworldly reading about this stuff. Did you know that, especially in a lot of the indigenous communities around the world, Spanish flu wiped out like half of the people in these communities? I mean, talk about devastation. Like in India, 20 million people died. In some of these Pacific Island communities, like half of the population was wiped out. And during this time, there was actually an interesting story of this American captain who was the governor of American Samoa. And this is back in the age of American imperialism. There was an American commander of this island, and he basically blockaded the island at the point of like threatening to sink ships that were trying to come through to visit the island during the Spanish flu epidemic. And that bold action actually caused not a single person to die in American Samoa from the Spanish flu in 1918. And I think half the population or something like that was wiped out in nearby German Samoa, which was managed, I think, by the German authorities. You know, if you're all interested in this outbreak kind of stuff, you know, check out some of the history of the Spanish flu. It's just really pretty fascinating. So let's talk about more things that you can control. Investing based off of your own personal circumstances versus just because you think that you need to buy because the market's low. That's not a good reason to buy just because the market's low. What you want to do is have a long-term plan and invest because it makes sense for the long term based on what your goals are. And so here's an example. If you'll lose your job at all in an economic recession, then you shouldn't be investing a ton of extra money right now. You should have a lot of cash, be able to survive a year or two of not finding a job. And you know, if you're in a risky industry, you want to have probably 1 to 2 years worth of expenses. You know, you're a typical person with just a regular average job probably needs 6 months because it's not too likely that you'll lose your job. And if you're in healthcare, like if you work as a physician at the VA, guess what? You can probably get by with 3 months expenses because you're probably not going to lose your job under any circumstances. So it's really a question of, should you be investing right now? Well, yes, if you have enough cash, if you have extra funds, if you have money that you can afford to put away and not need if something really bad happened in the economy, then you should be investing a lot right now. Don't worry about the market timing aspect of things because long-term, the market really beats any other kind of place you could put your money for the average person. You know, if you think about waiting around or trying to get it at the right time, it's just a losing proposition. The problem is when you invest, you cannot need the money for 10 years. If you need the money for 10 years, that's really kind of like too close. And you don't know for sure if you're not going to need the money for 10 years until you actually need it because you just lost your job and you're freaking out. So that's why I just kind of gauge how likely you are to lose your job and then invest everything over and above the amount that you feel like you need if you're being a little conservative in terms of your cash emergency spending that you need for emergency costs. I was originally going to title this show, Take Asymmetric Bets, or Asymmetric Bets Are Awesome. Here's kind of what I mean by this. So right now with coronavirus, we're kind of living in a time of an asymmetric bet with the kind of the opposite situation. Well, basically there's a chance that things could get so bad that it's like end of the world bad, and like everybody you know has coronavirus and tons of people are dying, and that's obviously a really bad situation. You know, how much control do you have over that, and how likely is that scenario to happen? You know, it's probably not super likely. So in that regard, investing when the market's down is probably a good thing if it's just a, you know, if your finances are solid and stable, right? Like back in the situation where we had the Cold War and we had the confrontation with Cuba with in the Soviet Union over the missile crisis, the downside was global nuclear war where financial assets are worth nothing. So really, like, financial assets decreasing in value during that time, it's kind of like, well, yeah, why wouldn't I buy? Because either these are going to be worthless or these are going to rebound and I'm going to make a lot of money. That's kind of how I feel almost about coronavirus right now. Like, either this is going to get so bad that like you're not going to be listening to a podcast about student loans, or things are going to get better and you're going to kick yourself for not investing over the next 10 years. Like, from, you know, 10 years from now, the market will probably be a lot higher than it is today. And you'll be like, dang, that would have been a great time to buy stocks. Another example of this is, it's amazing how many of y'all want to get involved in like super arcane, weird investing when you have something sitting right in front of you that's like a great investment, which is just using the education that you got, your human capital, to take the lower risk option. So I'll give you an example. I had a client recently who was really wanting to get involved in real estate or alternative investing. And he was really into this idea. You know, hey, I want to buy rental properties, or I want to buy, you know, commodities or something like that. And so when a dentist or a physician or a lawyer, veterinarian, when somebody that's a professional tells me this, I'm like, oh, wow, what competitive edge do you have in getting involved in these things? And the person said, well, none. And I said, oh, okay, so you're going to compete against hedge funds and professional investors and professional house flippers and buy all these rental real estate assets while you're not currently a practice owner and you don't have any practice equity. And why do you think that's a better idea? And so we talked a little bit more about it. And he basically was just looking to do something more interesting than just being an employee. And so if you think about, where is your competitive edge, right? Where are you able to do things that other people can't do it? So with the dentist, you're only competing against DSOs and maybe, you know, the dentist in your town. If you open a dental practice, well, that's still a fairly limited amount of competition. Whereas if you're competing to be a landlord, you're going to be competing way heavier with a lot more competition. That's a lot, well, you know, better funded, and then you're going to struggle to get a good return on capital with doing that. So what is an asymmetric bet? An asymmetric bet is when the downside is like defined and low probability or limited, and the upside is like very high and really positive, and that's the more likely outcome. Just think about this for this dentist's perspective. He could go invest in all these alternative assets that he knows nothing about, or he could go buy an out-of-the-way dental practice and maybe have to compete with, you know, a couple DSOs and the dentists in town. But the probability that his dental practice will be successful is about 99.7%. You know, and the 0.2% time it's not successful, it's alcohol or substance abuse, and 0.1% of the time it's business failures. So, you know, 99% plus chance that this thing is going to work out. What's the chance that you're going to be a successful landlord or alternative investor or buying the right individual stocks, right? It's a lot lower. There's lots of upside and defined downside with an asymmetric bet. So let's talk about my career real quick. If I had stayed doing exactly what I was doing, I had a defined upside and my downside was, I guess, limited. But in reality, that defined downside, trading that for the defined upside, was very much not worth it, because now I make, you know, a lot more than when I was working as an employee. And that's because I bet on myself. Right. And you should bet on yourself and your career and obviously do what you enjoy. I'm not saying be a business owner, but take a bet where the worst thing that can happen is, you know, fill in the blank. Right. So another friend of mine, he owns 100 rental properties. He did this because he basically just said, well, you know what? I'm just going to take a risk and I'm going to be comfortable with that. So he always would run the numbers and he would define what his downside was. And the downside was usually not being able to sell the house, you know, within 6 months or something, and taking, you know, a $10,000 loss or something compared to what he put into it, or, you know, it was some sort of defined downside risk. And so then why don't you get after it and take that bet you wanted to make? So think about coronavirus. The downside risk is Is it defined? Well, it sort of is. There's maybe like a base case scenario where like a lot of people get sick and tens of thousands of people die. Maybe the economy takes this massive hit and stocks plummet because of how interconnected the world economy is. Maybe in an extreme scenario, you're shutting your dental practice. You're not making an income. I mean, if things get that bad, it's kind of like, well, yeah, do you have cash in the bank? Because people will still accept the faith and credit of the United States probably until there's nuclear war, right? In which case they won't. You don't want to plan for the apocalypse because the apocalypse is just such a low probability event that when and if it does happen, you're just not going to be able to prepare for it just because you're not going to know what it's going to look like. So then if you really wanted to prepare for the apocalypse, go camping, learn how to cook, right, with a propane stove, or look how to cook with an open fire, target, shoot. I mean, shoot. That's, you know, it's just interesting to me how many people are like, oh my gosh, this coronavirus thing is going to kill us all. And I think that, like, if can you imagine if Facebook had been around during the Spanish flu, what would have happened? I mean, you would have seen out of your 1,000 connections on Facebook, 10 of them would have died. So you would have definitely seen all these memorials and posts and everything that would have made you feel like the world was ending. You know, when in fact it was just, you know, a 1% of the population event. And that was the worst outbreak basically ever since the Black Death. I don't know. I just think that you want to focus on taking risks in your career that makes sense. So buying stocks when markets are down, where you have plenty of cash stashed away in a very stable job, that's a measured risk. Your downside is defined, right? You lose your job or you shut down the office for a couple months. Like, that's the defined downside risk. And can you survive that? If you can, then it's a great decision to take that next step, take that risk, whatever you're trying to do. In terms of just the economy in general right now, there's always something going on. There will always be something going on. And that's why you need a long-term plan and to not stress and not to freak out, because people that do that end up a lot less wealthy than people that stay the course and are rational about things and make smart decisions for the long term. So, you know, if you have questions or comments or things going on like in your head with like this craziness that's happened in the world lately, go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail and just leave a comment or question. I'd love to get those. It takes 1 minute to just press the record button and speak into your phone. So do that. You can also be anonymous too, if you want to be. And then also just know that we tend to get pretty busy around the April, May, June timeframe, like super busy when people graduate, because we generally can help people save a lot of money with consolidation strategies when people are new grads. So a lot of people are like, oh, okay, I just want to have somebody figure this out for me. So if you want a student loan plan, go to studentloanplanner.com/help and get scheduled for that. Also, we're doing follow-up consults right now. So if you're an existing client and you want to get a follow-up plan, you can hit me up. I'll tell you the details about how to schedule one of those. And then finally, I don't know how long interest rates are going to stay this low. You know, with coronavirus and everything, like the 10-year treasury bond rate fell so fast, and it could easily rise so fast once people start getting not as afraid anymore and realize that the world is not ending, then the 10-year treasury bond will probably go back to more normal levels. So when that happens, refinancing rates are going to rise. So if you have existing debt that's private, or you know that you need to refinance your student loans for sure and not do forgiveness, then now's a wonderful time to apply to refinance your student loans. So go to studentloanplanner.com/refi and check out some links and save some money there. Thank y'all so much. Don't freak out. Just live your lives. Maybe do the social distancing. Follow whatever the CDC is recommending. But make smart decisions for the long term that reflect the fact and probabilities of the world not ending. Because that's probably what's going to happen. Take care. Have a great week.